something that's been occupying my thoughts this week, more than this week, is my capacity and my talent and my habitual tendency to seek identification or seek making a self. I've been noticing that quite a bit. A lot of people at Chikoji coming and going, and the weather's been actually pushing us around quite a bit. It's been a rather tough spring. It's kind of punching us back and forth, and I think I don't know if that's an adequate excuse, but I feel when external things are dramatic, or we tend to close up a little bit and sort of try and establish or redefine our identity, becomes more necessary, we think. Anyway, one of the issues for me is how good I am, I could say, at making a self, at defining myself, and particularly separating myself from others, from things. Gil calls this, he uses it like a verb, he calls it selfing. We're really good at selfing. We're actually experts. And yet here we are doing this practice together, this kind of unusual practice together, where we put ourselves in a situation where we are in effect trying to unself ourselves. It's a big issue because we're what would you call it? We're environmentally inclined to take care of, to identify or separate ourselves or be concerned with our own survival. And even though our own survival is, if we thought about how important it is for us to be related to everything and connected with all the things around us and be attuned to and sensitive to others and what's around us, still we have this tendency to separate, to isolate, to say, this is mine, this is me, who took my stuff, that kind of thing. Or I want to be alone, or I don't want to be alone. Yesterday, Jiro came to visit me, and I was busy being alone. I was very busy being alone. I had just made some soup, and I wanted to eat it and read my New Yorker. And after Jiro left, I felt really lonely, or terrible, or maybe a little guilty for my selfishness. When we sit down like this, my experience, and maybe your experience too, is that when we sit down and we're in a kind of setup where we make things very quiet and we don't move, we try not to distract ourselves, we stop in a sense, and our initial experience, or my initial experience, is to notice the flood or momentum of my selfing continuing. It's like I plaster it all over the wall, almost. The storylines are right there. The world according to me is right there. I'm fabricating a self. I'm in a situation where I can actually observe that. So it's very interesting, and it's very painful. Sometimes it's very discouraged sometimes to see how good I am at making a self or sustaining a self. So I'm kind of looking at that now, and it said that when the Buddha actually searched for a self, he tried all these alternate, there are many experimental practices that were going on in his time, and we have to presume that he didn't have a preconceived view of non-self or anatman. He was actually looking for a self, or looking for his true self, you could say, or his authentic self, or whatever. And he didn't find it. He did not find it. And his disappointment or his failure was his enlightenment. He was liberated, he was free, he was liberated by the experience of searching for a self and not finding one. He found the realm of form that we all share, this common physical situation. And he found the realm of sensations, the realm of the perceptions, the realm of mental objects or impulses, it's called, some stava, and also the realm of consciousness itself, of just being conscious. But he didn't find a self. He failed, basically. And that failure was his success, so to speak. His liberation. Me, I have no problems finding a self. How about you? Any luck?
Just what I found was the self just being a concept, an idea, persona of creation. And then in that moment of realizing that, not wanting to recreate a persona, and then getting up and trying to move forward with that,
and without it, huh?
Without it, and seeing that, you know, that there was this necessity to somehow have a persona in the workaday world to go and create this thing that does this does these activities and actions that are required, you know, to go out there, like driving a car has requirements. It's like driving this thing has requirements.
Even opening a door has requirements. Yeah.
And just dealing with that, and that, having that realization of searching for a self and then finding that there isn't one was beautiful and wonderful, and then terrifying. And and then realizing everything was just a construct. Ideas, thoughts, opinions. You know. And then just not wanting to recreate that. We had to talk about that once.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Really just wanting to sit and be without something like that, but then understanding that even that's a persona. The persona of not wanting to create persona.
Yeah, it gets set up as a concept itself.
Yes, yeah.
It's tricky.
And just one other thing that was interesting, the study of the sensory parts of the mind that have relation to like smell and memory and sight and all of these perceptions that we have, they're able to find the centers in the brain where that happens, you know, mm-hmm. here.
Mm-hmm.
And they are trying diligently to find self, and they're having absolutely no luck. I've read several studies on that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They can't find where self is. They can find where smell is,
uh-huh.
sight, you know, memory, movement, but they can't find any source for self with the technology
like,
that
like
have.
in the
brain,
cerebral cortex,
brain itself,
the point of awareness.
Yes, there's no little thing that percolates that's like, this is where self comes from. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. The other side is that we have a sense of this practice or practice itself as a kind of returning home. We're coming back to ourselves, we could say. We come back to as it isness. That sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Kategori Roshi always used to call this the return home practice. This is return home practice again and again and again. He'd repeat that. This is return home practice. And he meant like it's not... Of course, it's not something outside of yourself. It's not something out there. It's not something you get. It's not a better state. It's returning to your true nature, to yourself just as you are. So that sounds, initially at least, it sounds contradictory, doesn't it? Like, return home to yourself, and yet there's no self, there's nobody home. Wait a minute. Did someone leave the back door open?
I think the sense of... That there is a kind of form, a kind of something when we talk about self, and when we talk about things, there's something there. And one useful way to look at it seems to me is like a river or an institution that goes on for many years. It has many people who participate in it, but they come and go.
Mm-hmm.
And the institution as such sort of continues, but it the same things are not there for very long. Even the buildings tend to come and go to some extent. And it's more obvious with something like a river. There's this kind of sense of flow through, and the flowing aspect follows a certain pattern which is somewhat identifiable, and that's the sort of
we call it the source of the river that
right,
you were talking
yeah.
about.
So it kind of reminds me of how you're talking about, you know, that that is a lot of a habit, and so I like that to then also see.
There's a Sanskrit word called samstava, which actually means flow, the flow of the river, the flow of being.
Mm-hmm.
So, samstava, it's called. They talked about it back
mm-hmm.
then. Too. So I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, I just think that it's, you know, to sit down and experience that and kind of open up to that flow, and then also seeing that there's potential to really open up to those dimensions and find balance within each dimension, balance between all dimensions, that there's a real potential to besides the formlessness, say, just observing the form, that there's an approach to actually finding balance. And it reminds me of the Buddha's way of very systematically saying, okay, we're not going to talk about emptiness or nirvana, but this is how we can kind of hone in and balance those dimensions of your being to find a sense of contentment or happiness as a person, as a persona, or as a creation, whatever it is, because you're still experiencing it either way.
Initially, like the Buddha's practices, the Buddhists and the early disciples, they set up a situation, well, in a sense, like we're doing the same thing. They set up a situation of what you might call poverty, or kind of spiritual poverty, or a kind of experiential poverty. So we set up a kind of very poor situation here, where we don't move. We're animate beings, but we set up a situation where we don't move, where we move moderately, we're still. And also with our mind, particularly if our mind is distracted, we pick an object of meditation, our posture or our breath, and we just stay with that one thing and try and let a lot of the creativity or fullness or thickness of our mind sort of drop away or become more transparent. So we actually set up a situation where we're really poor. And then see what happens. You know, you could say where things are really simple or really elemental or basic, but that's kind of almost too fancy a word. I like the word poor. We become poor. When we sit down, we become poor.
But that in itself is very rich.
Yeah. It's said that when the Buddha, they used to go with the begging bowls, and that when the Buddha and his disciples would go, they would hold their bowl out and show people that there was no food in there. They had no food. And if the people wanted them to be around, to sustain them, they would put food in their bowl. They would say, I see your poverty. I see your emptiness. I see that you're really empty. And I want you to continue to live, so I'm put some food in your bowl. And it said that the older arhats and the Buddha himself, they were better. Because they've been practicing for a while, they were better. They were emptier. They were poorer.
Hmm.
So their bowl looked more empty. So when they showed the people their empty bowl, they people put more food in their bowl. because it looked emptier, you know. And so they had to share their food with the young disciples who weren't empty enough to actually show so their emptiness wasn't visible. So the older disciples had to share their food with the younger ones, because they weren't empty enough. Interesting story. So what about this selfing thing that we do? Any advice? Did we just like cut the head right off of it, the monstrous self?
It'll grow another one. Like a lizard or grows a tail.
Like a hydra. Two will come back. Three.
Three more.
What do you find are the primary means for selfing? What kind of act or thought? How does one self? How do you find that selfing happens? Essentially.
Have you thought about it?
Well, I was just trying to think about it now. And I was just thinking about when I say I, there's a definite there's a definite reference in somewhere in my mind to I, which is satisfactory and it works.
We all... I don't mean to speak for everyone, but I know I do, and with many other people, they carry around a little package. It's like a policy package, like an ID card almost, of who you are. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a policy that you carry around, this little... that's what you mean? That kind of... How is that produced? Huh? Or how is it sustained? Mm-hmm.
I think that...
What invokes it?
Where did it come from?
I've heard that the Buddha, when he taught about awareness of body, he emphatically said that awareness of form, awareness of body, that we should concentrate or focus on not that which is being affected, as if it was a thing, but just focus on the being affected.
Mm-hmm.
And he said in the sutra, in the Pali Canon, he said, affected of, in the way he talked, affected by what? And then he answered his own question, affected by heat, by cold, by mosquitoes.
No self-identification?
There's just the being affected, not that which is being affected.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another expression of what you might call poverty, like the construction of a policy, a self-policy is a view, actually, that he was able to experience existence without that as an overlay. And that's how he taught, to be aware, just to be aware of body. And the same thing with mind. I know I often catch myself thinking that I am what I think. I am what I think. I think this and this and this and this and this, and I have all these opinions, and I have all these views, and I know that that's Steve, and these are cushions, and that's that's black or something like that. I have all these identification things. That's part of it. That's some, I would say, is somewhat neutral. And then on top of that, there's this is good, this is bad, this will harm me, this will benefit me. I want this, I don't want that. Then that's laid on top of that as sort of an embellishment of just identification. That I catch myself, I notice that I think I am what I think. So the question comes up for me, and maybe for you too: are you what you think? Are you what you think? Huh? are you your thoughts?
No. I don't think so.
Or are you the thinker?
Are you the thinker? Yeah. And what is the thinker? Is the thinker separate from the thoughts?
I think they all arise at once. Everything's just going like this. Nothing's separate. There isn't this, and that, and that, and that. It's all arising. And that we just, when you look at babies, they don't know they exist because they haven't yet formed that in their mind, the concept of that I'm separate from this, and this, and this is mine and that's yours. You know, it's natural. The natural occurrence of mind, of healthy, normal mind, that as we grow and we mature and we understand things, we gather thoughts and memories and opinions and judgments. This is bad, this feels good. I like feeling good, I want to feel good more. I don't like to feel pain. You know, these things just all arise naturally. But then there can be this awakening or awareness to the fact that that is not who I am.
That's production.
The feelings, the emotions, that's not me. Those are just thoughts, feelings, emotions, opinions, judgments. But that's not me. And it's not even really important to know what me is, because it's all just thinking.
Would you call it, that's fabrication?
Yeah, it's all just thought. And that's its nature. That's just what it does. It just thinks and does things like that. And then when we sit and, like you were saying, sit here and come home and take away the distractions that we have all throughout our life, and sit and just be and observe, in observance of the fact that the mind has that nature, there are these moments where there are gaps between that are very interesting to experience. I wouldn't call that me, I'd call it all me, but isn't it, it's kind of all mind, it's all thinking, it's all thought.
The one of the definitions of nirvana is to unbind.
Yes.
Unbinding. It's actually a better, sometimes it's translated as extinction or dissolution, but a closer definition of the etymology is to unbind or to unfabricate.
Mm-hmm.
So, question is, I mean, can there be unfabricated life? Can there be unfabricated
crap.